This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for joining us this afternoon. On the program today, we're going to take a look at the front page. Journalist and scholar Michelle Weldon is our guest. She says there's been a big change on the front pages of our daily newspapers in recent years. She says the stories are more personal, more inclusive, and less distant from readers' experiences. Why has this happened? Is it a good development? Michelle Weldon writes about the new face of America's newspapers in her latest book, Everyman News, The Changing American Front Page. Listeners, I invite you to join our discussion with your questions and comments. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number is 800-222-9455. Michelle Weldon, our guest, is an assistant professor at Northwestern University's Medill School of Journalism. She is a former columnist and reporter for the Dallas Times-Herald. She's also been a freelance op-ed and feature contributor to the Chicago Tribune and Los Angeles Times. In addition to Everyman News, she's the author of Save Your Life, How to Honor Your Story Through Journaling, and I Closed My Eyes, Revelations of a Battered Woman. Her new book, Everyman News, The Changing American Front Page, is published by the University of Missouri Press. Again, those phone numbers, 333-9455 and 800-222-9455. Professor Weldon, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Celeste.
My pleasure. Well, how do you define the term Everyman News?
Well, it could also have been called Every Man or Every Woman News, but it addresses the democratization of news today and how there's more ordinary citizens reflected in the front pages and less top-down official news and more personal stories from ordinary citizens.
Okay. Now, you identify September 11th as a pivotal point for Everyman journalism. Would you talk about how September 11th has contributed to the Everyman journalism?
Well, I think it was a pivotal point in journalism history because it was a time when there was little to no information coming down from the top. There were no answers that day. Nothing could have been reported that was the official answer to the tragedies that Americans endured that day. So the real stories were coming from the street, literally. And the more compelling news was about the survival of the citizens and reactions from people to those events that day. And it allowed for a more personal take on daily events that followed after 9/11, because personal stories were what captured the day's events on 9/11.
Yeah. Also, those stories gave us a chance to do some grieving and to console one another, didn't they?
Right. A lot has been written about how journalism became much more emotional after that and allowed for grieving. Even the New York Times portraits in grief, the salutations to the people who had fallen 9/11, the ordinary people and their life stories, you know, told briefly. So that day and the way journalists talked about and wrote about that day allowed for more personal stories to be told and in a much more emotional and compelling way.
Okay. Now, can you give us some other examples of Everyman News, the stories that Everyman News tackles and how the stories are reported?
Well, it's what I call the holy trinity of changes in content, style, and sourcing that it makes up what is the genre of Everyman News. And what I mean by content, it is not just what has been called the official stenography of events. Reporters no longer just sit in news conferences and take down what the official or the expert has to say and reports that. But the stories that are told include some of that information, but it's more about reactions of the average citizen to that information or that announcement. And the style, how I refer to that, is the way the stories are written. They're more personal, they're more anecdotal, They're in a much more conversational, casual language. And that has to do with blogging and citizen journalism and the interactivity of stories. They're no longer just official accounts of what happened yesterday. And the sourcing refers to how stories are reported. That's no longer just the word taken of officials in authority, but it is reactions from people on the street and how the average person looks and views at official events.
Yeah. Now, some time ago, even in newspaper stories, in what we would call maybe hard news stories, mm-hmm. I noticed a shift in tense. The stories went from using the past tense in reporting events to the present tense, you know, giving us a more active or a more it's happening now kind of feel.
Well, it has always been that way in broadcast journalism,
right.
But in print news is reported in the past tense unless it's a feature. So what you're probably noticing is there are more features, you know, in what had previously been the hard news holes. And what I mean by hard news, and what I believe you mean by hard news, is that it's a strict regurgitation of events. Something happened yesterday. It is a newsworthy topic mm-hmm. or happening that must be reported now. And a feature has traditionally been considered softer, but it could also be more enterprising and insightful and inclusive, and it does not just revolve around what happened today or yesterday.
Yeah. But when let me see if I can come up with an example. Say, for example, this evening when I go home and open up the paper, we have an evening paper here, and let's say there's a story about a city council action. Instead of reporting the Champaign City Council last night on a vote of whatever, decided to whatever, the paper might say rather, the Champaign City Council is moving ahead with plans to.
Well, you're absolutely right, and that is a reaction to the fact that most people already know the news by the time mm-hmm. the newspaper arrives. So they have to have a new tack. They have to say what's upcoming, what is the result, what will happen tomorrow or next week or next month, because the people reading the paper already know the basic facts. They could have gotten it on the radio, television, on a website, but newspapers no longer just deliver news. They're really story papers.
Yeah. So when did that begin, this trend to advance the story?
Well, it was my instinct that it's been happening to a great degree since 9/11. And I measured papers in 2001, pre-9/11, and 2004. And there was a dramatic shift in the number of features. So I think with the onset of internet news and how more and more people, 71% of people are getting their news online daily, as opposed to 43%, according to a Pew study in 2006, get their news from a daily paper, I think newspapers can't compete any longer. They're not first with the news. They can never win the race. So they have to, you know, deliver a different kind of product with a different kind of content.
And for many papers, or for some papers, that online edition is 24/7.
Oh, absolutely. And it's not just what was happening in earlier iterations of newspaper websites was that it was just considered shovelware. You shoveled the print copy onto the website kind of as an afterthought. Oh, well, read in the paper first, and then it'll be on the website. You know, check what you didn't get on the website. And I think it's the other way around now. Now the website drives what will be in the newspaper.
Hmm. Well, the online edition of the New York Times offers readers a look at what stories are most popular, what stories have been the most emailed, the most blogged, the most searched.
Absolutely, and that's another aspect of Everyman News and how readers and consumers are driving what content is produced where. And it's a little bit scary thinking what's the most popular story could have been, you know, something about, you know, Britney Spears or Paris Hilton, when that isn't the most important story by a long stretch.
Yeah. So What are the arguments for and against everyman news, everyman journalism?
Well, the arguments for is that we brought consumers to the table. It's more interactive, more inclusive. Different kinds of stories are reported. A diversity of stories are told, and information that otherwise could not have been spread out is. So that's a good thing, and we're listening to readers more. It's no longer just a handful of decision makers in an editorial meeting deciding what will be in the paper tomorrow, an edict from above. So, you know, readers are considered in that process. Their input is important. That's all very, very good. What isn't good is what it could result in, what I call Chicken Little journalism. This is the kind of viral story that isn't vetted and turns out to be inaccurate. And it's hard to correct those myths. And it's real easy to put something up quickly and have it not be true and accurate and truthful. So that's a real danger.
Who are the champions of everyman journalism, and who has doubts and who hates it?
Everyman journalism can also include a narrative storytelling, and the champions are the Pulitzer Prize winners every year, you know, from the major papers as well as smaller papers like the Oregonian, as well as, you know, the Washington Post, the Chicago Tribune, Los Angeles Times, and the New York Times. They delve into stories of ordinary people, and they tell them extraordinarily well. And they have the time to spend reporting a story in depth and presenting it in a profound and compelling way. And these are stories that can be life-changing. You think about a topic or a trend in a completely different way because you have read and been involved in this story. So people who follow those kinds of stories and who tell those kinds of stories, they champion everyman news. What contractors say about everyman news, what is negative about it, is that it lacks accuracy and depth. It's just commentary and reaction. It's just people talking about a story. It isn't really in-depth. It isn't enterprising. It's just more voices. It doesn't necessarily mean more information. It's like more people at a party talking doesn't really guarantee that it's more in depth.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Michelle Weldon. She is the author of Everyman News, The Changing American Front Page. Our guest is an assistant professor at Northwestern University's Medill School of Journalism. She's a former columnist and reporter for the Dallas Times-Herald. She's also been a freelance op-ed and feature contributor to the Chicago Tribune and Los Angeles Times. She is the author of Everyman News, The Changing American Front Page, and that's what we're talking about here this afternoon in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn, and listeners, I invite your telephone calls this afternoon. Your questions and comments are invited. What do you think about this trend in journalism? 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Is trend an okay word, or would makeover be a better word?
Well, some newspapers are, you know, going slowly into this trend, and I guess that's a good way to look at it, but it's a tumultuous time in the media industry, not just in print news, the traditional ink on paper newspaper, but there's been so much disruption across the landscape, in broadcast, in radio, in magazine, in newspaper, digitally on websites, because there is so much information available from, you know, an infinite number of sources and sites and, you know, printed text. So some media companies and interests are looking to make over themselves to try and, you know, create a broader audience and following in a brand that is reliable, because there are still only 24 hours in a day. And if, you know, one person has 10 sources for news and information, they really you know, may sometime drop down to 8, and or they may increase to 11 or 12, but they still only have X amount of time to spend gathering information.
Hmm. What is citizen journalism? This is a term you mentioned earlier, and how is it affecting America's newspapers?
Well, it's a huge trend across the country and internationally. It is websites produced by non-journalists, literally by citizens who call themselves journalists, who are gathering text and video and audio and photography, putting slideshows on websites to cover their community or even their ideology. But it is an area that has been missed by larger newspapers for cost-cutting reasons. So it's hyper-local and hyper-personal. You know, it could be as simple as covering, you know, the local youth football games, you know, live on podcast on a certain community website. And there is no gatekeeper here. You know, everything goes. So someone could put up a story that there is, you know, parade with, you know, 700 people down his or her street, and it would be absolutely not true. So there's no accuracy check, you know, from an editor or a trained journalist. And there are great concerns about ethics here, you know, who's telling the news and why. But the good thing about citizen journalism is everything can be covered and stories can be told, and also that other citizen journalists hold each other in check.
Mm-hmm.
If you write something inaccurate, someone's going to call you on it. So it may not be up there for long, but there is a danger of, you know, something being unethical or inaccurate.
Yeah. These developments are relatively new, and I'm wondering, do you think we'll become better consumers, better editors for ourselves of the information that's out there?
You know, that's a hope, but I think, you know, this is a selfish comment because I train journalists. You know, I'm in a journalism school, and this quarter I'm teaching 220 freshmen in two different courses, basic fundamental skills courses, and we spend a lot of time discussing ethics and what is the proper ethical behavior in this situation, and some of these concerns they've never even thought about. So, you know, how can someone who you know, could be a lawyer by day, gathering information by night, how is that person going to know that, yes, it matters that your spouse is on the board of this company that you're writing about, or even this comment that you're making, if they're not aware of all the concerns that could go into affecting content?
How has teaching journalism changed since the days you were in journalism school and how you're teaching your students today?
You know, that's really interesting. I think back, I went to Northwestern, the Medill School of Journalism, 1975 to 79, and our instructors, who were mostly all male, were telling us that the only job to get was on the national desk of the New York Times. So that was what we were to aspire to, and that was really it. And I was thinking to myself, you know, probably somewhere in the middle of the first quarter of my freshman year, that if they tell this to all of us, and there were 160, 170 students that year, and they've been telling this to every class, you know, for the last how many years, how exactly can the New York Times National Desk accommodate all of us? So a whole lot of us are going to get rejections from that job position. So I started to think back then that you needed to be more adaptive in your view of journalism than we were told. And it is so drastically different in the last 5 years as an instructor of journalism. The news is bleak about, you know, traditional newspaper jobs. In some arenas, radio is growing at a fast and a brisk pace, but traditional newspapers are dying, and I don't think the death knell can be rung for all of newspapers, but circulation has been sliding for 20 years, and revenues also have been sliding. And it isn't just a migration to the internet. It is a dispersion of the audience across, you know, a myriad of media options. But how we teach journalism students now is they are to be multimedia journalists, so they're marketable, you know, in any arena. They can, you know, shoot video. They can gather audio. They can put together a photo slideshow with audio. They can, you know, write superb text. They can tell long-form stories. They can write books, you know, later in their career because they've been given the fundamentals. We teach them all the technical tools now that they need to know, and those will also change in the next few years, but at least they will have an understanding of the need for multimedia and how to tell stories across platforms.
Is screen presence something that they'll have to have?
Pardon me?
Screen presence. Will they have to have a screen test?
Less so, because that model of the overpaid, two really handsome anchors reading the news, that really isn't the case so much anymore. There's Al Gore started what's called Current.tv, is a network of really vibrant news telling and storytelling online, and it's also broadcast on hundreds of stations. It is more about a live documentary feel to telling news, telling stories briefly in 2 and 3 mm-hmm. minutes without someone sitting at a desk, very removed and distant. So what is required of storytelling now is an immersion into the story and less about the person who's telling it, less about the narrator and more about the everyman.
Yeah, interesting. So YouTube is kind of the way we're headed in that regard, and in terms of anyone can, well, I'm not putting this out very clearly, but in terms of, let's say right now the one model is like a newspaper online that has features where you can go and you can click on to a window and you get the reporter telling you the story, and you'll see the reporter and you'll see his or her story. You'll see video and that kind of thing. So the presence, you don't have to be Katie Couric to do that.
Right. You can be anyone. And that's a really exciting opportunity as a reporter, as a journalist, as a news gatherer, and not just that you get to tell, sides of your story. You know, I think back on all the aspects of a story that I have cut over the years. I was like, oh, for space reasons, that had to be cut, and that was such a gem, and couldn't use that photo, and that quote was wonderful, and if only people could have heard what this person sounded like. We were so limited back then to, ink on paper, and now, the photographers especially love this new age of journalism because they don't have to just choose the one story for the front page. They can put 35, 40 photographs on the website in a slideshow, so they don't have to be so limiting. The thing that is curious to me is if all of our outtakes are showing, who has time to consume all of this? Yeah. You have to draw the line somewhere. So, is the audience really more informed or less informed? Are they more deeply informed about subjects that they choose and more shallowly informed about what they ought to know about?
Yeah, because the slideshows can be beautiful, but then you're taking time away from other important stories of the day or of the period of history that we're in. Where are your students, your journalism students, getting their news? Do they read a paper?
Well, woe is me, Celeste. if you look at the current events quizzes, you would wonder where they're getting their news at all. Mm-hmm. Very few of them read a physical paper. There are a few. I hesitate to say that we're raised well, but their tradition in their family was to read a newspaper daily, and they still embrace that, although they get supplemental news online. I would say 75 to 80% of the students get their news online. And some of them consider blogs a source of news. Some of them consider Jon Stewart's Daily Show a source of news. We quickly try to tell them that that isn't so, that that's a discussion of news, but it's not, you know, strict delivery of news. So they decide the sources of news, and it isn't necessarily what you or I would have recommended.
Yeah. Well, we're old fogies.
Right.
What has led these young people into journalism school? Why do they want to be reporters?
It's an interesting shift, even over just the last few years. I've been teaching at Northwestern for 13 years in journalism, graduate and undergraduate. And probably at the start, there really was an interest in becoming a star. We would all on the first day of the graduate program say, you know, why do you want to be in journalism? Some of them say, because I want to be Oprah Winfrey, because I want to be Katie Couric, because I want to be Tom Brokaw. And it was all about really the star celebrity journalists, and they wanted to make a name for themselves and, you know, secondarily do good work. But I have seen a shift in a real need now for students to write about social justice issues and their desire to make a difference and their desire to tell stories that wouldn't necessarily be told. I don't see that I Want to Be a Star happening so much anymore.
Hmm. 75 to 80% of your students are getting their news online. What about the rest of the population? How many people read a paper on a daily basis? How are subscriptions faring?
Well, I just saw a statistic the other day. 51 million Americans still read the newspaper every day. Actually buy the newspaper every day. They say 124 million read the newspaper every day. I guess that's all the copies left in Starbucks or at the doctor's office. Or if you pass it around your house, multiple users for a single copy. So that still is fairly hefty. If you think, you know, 60 million people voted for Bush in 2004, 51 million are reading the newspaper every day. But 71% of people are getting their news online. It's not exclusive, one or the other. People generally do a hybrid of both or multiple sources of news.
To what extent is everyman journalism a business decision?
I think it is becoming that. I think newspapers, I wouldn't call them desperate, but I'm in Chicago, and
it's tough.
Getting fairly desperate here. The Chicago Sun-Times and the Chicago Tribune have literally changed the size of their newspaper. The physical product, and the Sun-Times is doing a drastic amount of staff cuts, which affects the news gathering. And everyman news can be a cheaper way to gather the news, not relying on, you know, foreign reports and, you know, really expensive columnists, but allowing citizens to the table, contributing some of their comments, you know, to the website, telling their stories, and reporters going out and getting reaction can be, you know, a less expensive way to tell stories and deliver the news. And I also think newspapers across the board are looking for a development of their brand. What would distinguish them? And there are papers, you know, across the country with reputations for being papers that tell good stories. Mm-hmm. And these are, you know, some quite predictable papers that, you know, win Pulitzers every year, but that is their brand, is their story. Not that they get something first, but that they have solid reporters and writers who deliver something different. And that could be, you know, in the physical paper, or it could be on the online site for the newspaper.
Journalist and scholar Michelle Weldon, our guest this afternoon here on The Afternoon Magazine. She's an assistant professor at Northwestern University's Medill School of Journalism. She's also the author, most recently, of Everyman News, The Changing American Front Page. This is The Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with a question, a comment, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let's take a call now, a listener on line four, the toll-free line, calling in from Bartlett this afternoon. Good afternoon.
Hi, good morning, or good afternoon. yeah, I was wondering, do you see a lot of people wanting to go into journalism because of the politics? You know, is there any influence in there? And is there, like, maybe, I personally see it, an influence not being centered, but basically going from the left or to the right or both. Is there any? I guess I'm taking Fox's no fair and balanced reporting. I don't see that anymore.
Well, in some sources, they're still fair and balanced, but you know, like Fox wouldn't necessarily be one of those sources I recommend for fair and balanced reporting. The goal is to be ethical and to be inclusive with your sources and not to insert your opinion and to, you know, tell the story objectively. That still is what we teach our students in journalism school. And I do see a great deal of idealism in some of the students who do want to change the world, who don't necessarily have a strict left or right vantage point, but they do want to be involved. You know, it's an election year. They're real excited about that. And, you know, it's a big news time. And they see opportunities for them to have a voice.
Mm-hmm. Michelle Weldon, our guest this afternoon here on The Afternoon Magazine. Other calls are invited, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. How do they judge or grade the coverage that they see online?
That they, as the students?
Yeah, that they consume. How do they talk about what they see? What are their criticisms, if they have any?
Well, you know, it's interesting. This week in one of the courses was the topic was ethics. So they're all contributing sites where there have been breaches of ethics and people have been fired for certain things, everything from doctoring a photo to making, you know, a snarky comment about, you know, Notre Dame online, I mean, or on air. So they talk about that a lot and they're somewhat shocked that there are breaches of ethics and that it affects coverage. So I think they're cynical to a certain degree about how do you tell stories cleanly. And they're a little bit afraid of themselves, I guess, that they're not capable of doing that. But, you know, I keep telling them, you know, to be confident. And if they're diligent in their approach and their intention to tell the story well without bias and to be inclusive and, you know, to do their best work, that, you know, they don't necessarily have to be afraid of being wrong or getting it wrong or doing it wrong.
Let's take another call. A listener on a cell phone. Line four. Hi.
Hi. First of all, a disclaimer. My daughter is going to Medill, and I hope for the right reasons. But my question is, I'm curious, what percentage of students at Medill and then percentage of students in journalism nationally go into the, shall I say, for-profit mode, advertising agency, PR, and publicity? Thank you, and I'll hang up.
Well, thank you for sending your daughter to Medill. We appreciate that very much, and I'm sure that I've taught her because I teach all of the freshmen. Initially, I believe they go into journalism. They go into, you know, newspapers or magazines or online sites or they're freelance. I don't think a great percentage go into advertising or marketing and communications out of the journalism program. At Medill, we also have an IMC program, integrated marketing program, that is a graduate degree. But those students, of course, go into marketing and PR and advertising. I think it's perhaps, and this I don't have the statistics, but it would be less than 20% who would go into marketing, communications, and advertising with a journalism degree.
I want to thank the listener for his call this afternoon. It makes me think of another question that I wanted to ask you about, and that is public relations, advertising. Have these fields had an influence in the way news stories are told? Because advertisers do a very good job at telling stories, and so do the public relations people.
Absolutely, and I'm so glad you brought that up, because that is a big factor in my book that I discuss, is about the non-editorial everyman approach of ordinary citizens in advertising and in public relations. There is an emphasis on the story of the consumer that helps identify the brand. If you think back to the Dove ads that created such a stir 2 years ago, the ordinary women, in their white undies, telling the story of Dove, you can see and experience many different websites, from Volvo.com to WhiteCastle.com to Botox.com and Hanes, where they invite the consumer to tell your story. Click on here and tell us your story interacting with the product. And a lot of advertising is storytelling of the consumer, and it is not celebrity-based predominantly anymore. It's more about storytelling of the average citizen. And that has definitely influenced journalism. People want their information told in a narrative form, not just bullets of information and factoids.
Mm. And then the Dove women show up on Oprah.
Right.
Very interesting. So everything is rubbing off on everything else, I guess.
Well, it speaks to how we want to receive information, and that was what I was really curious about, and that's beyond the scope of a journalist. I mean, the True, I counted all these newspaper stories on front pages, and I did analysis in that way and interviewed a lot of journalists and experts about these changes. But I was interested in culturally why we consider personal stories so sacrosanct and have such a cynicism for official stories and the official line, and we're so skeptical of spin, yet we take at full value the story of the average Joe and Jane. And a part of that appetite is also reflected in reality TV. We see, most of the airwaves now and television shows are filled with stories, wife swap, super nanny. Even the game shows are celebrating, the average person. And that is worth our time and attention, to pay attention to what those people have to say, not just celebrities anymore.
Yeah. Well, when I was reading in your book, Everyman News, about the portraits of grief and your analysis of that, I was reminded also of how we have changed how we memorialize folks these days. And I thought back to the Vietnam Memorial, which I think was a pivotal memorial, Maya Lin's structure in Washington, D.C., and then the Oklahoma City Memorial with the chairs. I mean, here we have names and we have, we have markers for individuals.
Right. And, I think that is a testament to who we are as a culture now in this point in history. I think it has really shifted, from the information age to the story age. And we really celebrate the sanctity of each individual life and story, and the reading of the names on the 9/11 anniversary. Who are these people? Who are their stories? And we crave this connection to each other's narrative. And the way news is presented now is through the portal of character and narrative. It's how we want to experience information. And that's really interesting to think about why that is. Is it because we've just been hardened by all the information that's been thrown at us, all the facts, all the different kinds of spin from official sources we just don't have an appetite for it anymore. We really want to hear individual people speaking.
Yeah. Well, it was interesting. One of the things that you note in the book is that, you know, Time Magazine, you know, named us.
Right.
Person of the Year. 2006.
Right, and you know, and there's YouTube. It isn't TheyTube. It's you. It's trying to be inclusive, and you know, as society becomes global and more expansive, it also becomes more intimate. You have accessibility to anyone, really. You know, who has access to the internet or Skype. You can speak to someone, you can communicate to someone, and it's almost infinite, our reach, and that we want the personal characteristics of individuals. We want to know that more than we want to know dollar amounts and factoids and bullets. We really like this slow dance of information rather than the quick hits of facts.
Mm. One of the things that happened, or that we talked about a good deal following September 11th, was the need for learning more about others who are very different from us. And there was a call for more international news. Where do you see that today?
Well, I think we realized our myopia with 9/11, and that, you know, we weren't just the only ones on center stage. And that's a very good thing. You know, newsrooms have traditionally not been diverse. They're predominantly white and male. And the goal is to diversify newsrooms so that the content becomes broader and more inclusive. But while that may not happen immediately, what's necessary is to have diversity of thought, to think about other stories outside of our own experience, other cultures, other individuals, what stories need to be told outside of our own community. And that is also part of Everyman News, the desire to tell the stories that we wouldn't necessarily know. And diversity has become an element of newsworthiness. It wasn't considered so much anymore, and it is now. Like, what don't I know, and what do I need to know to be a good global citizen?
Hmm. Are other areas of the newspaper changing as well? Your analysis really focused on the front pages of how many newspapers was it? And a wide variety of newspapers.
Yes,
as well.
It was 20 newspapers, about 160 issues, about 850 stories. Well, the front page stories have stolen their content from other parts of the paper. Front pages used to be about the hard news, what happened yesterday. So really, it has shifted the identities of the feature sections. If the front page is a feature section, then, you know, what do you do with the other content? So it becomes more interactive. There's more graphics elsewhere, you know, a different kind of photograph, more different kinds of graphics, and, you know, this is where you link to. This is information. These are boxes of places you could go. So it really has shifted the content of the entire paper. Yeah. I think the front page, how you need to look at it, is it's the window dressing of the department store inside.
Yeah.
So you have a hint of what is going to be inside. And it has shifted all the other merchandise inside.
How many papers offer readers the reporter's email address?
I think that's pretty universal now.
Yeah.
And that, you know, it's funny. When I was in a newsroom in Dallas, the Dallas Times-Herald, a reader would call the features department, and we would pass the reader around and say, oh, my gosh, a reader's on the phone. Here, you take it. We were, you know, arrogant. We didn't care what the readers thought. And, yeah, just a minute, you're on hold. And now that is absolutely not the case. You are accountable to your audience, and you are, you know, required to put your email up there and to respond to the reader's requests, and, you know, be not just someone who delivers the news and slams the door.
Yeah, they're gold.
Right.
They're golden.
Right.
Yeah. How about one last question here, and then we've got to wrap up. Op-ed features, the op-ed page and columnists have
has that part of the paper also changed a little bit in how those pieces are written?
Right. Well, we've asked more ordinary citizens to the op-ed table. I don't know if you've noticed that, you know, it's not just columnists who are contributing to that section anymore. It's more of a decision to have, you know, real citizens, you know, display their opinions and comment about it. But, you know, there still are superstars in the opinion world, and they're syndicated and they're followed, not just in print, but also digitally on websites and on broadcast. And I don't think that's going to change. I just think more people will be brought to the table to be able to give their opinions.
Yeah, that's happened here as well. We have a feature that we run in the afternoons on Friday during All Things Considered. It's called The Public Square.
See?
Yep. There you go.
Yeah.
Well, it's a fascinating time. Michelle Weldon, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me, Celeste.
My pleasure. Michelle Weldon is an assistant professor at Northwestern University's Medill School of Journalism. She is the author of Everyman News, The Changing American Front Page. This is her latest book. It is published by the University of Missouri Press. And our thanks this afternoon to the folks at Northwestern and our technical director there, Brendan Cosgrove, for his help with this wonderful connection between ISDN connection between Evanston and Champaign-Urbana this afternoon.